Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC, and remember our latest crowdsourcing or group journalism project. It's called Are You Being Gouged? We're looking to see what stores and what neighborhoods in our area have the best and worst prices for common items that people eat and drink. Go to your local grocery store and just write down the prices of these three items. You don't have to buy them. Milk, lettuce, and beer. Specifically, a quart of regular whole milk, non-organic, a head of iceberg lettuce, and a six-pack of 12-ounce bottles of Budweiser. Then post the prices and the store's location on our website at WNYC.org. Again, a quart of regular whole milk, non-organic, a head of iceberg lettuce, and a six-pack of 12-ounce bottles of Bud. It's that simple. Then post the prices and the store's location on our website at WNYC.org. You'll see the instructions there, and we will figure out, are you being gouged? If you've already posted your prices and are willing to go one step further, we will ask you to go to another nearby neighborhood and check prices there. We'll have details on that probably tomorrow. And if you want to read more about Are You Being Gouged, go to WNYC.org or just go to the store and get us those price points. Now, on Thursdays this month, we've been having weekly visits from Lockhart Steele, publisher of Curbed, the New York real estate blog. He's back for his last one now, boo-hoo. Aww. And mostly we've been following the subprime mortgage meltdown and exploring how it's been affecting New York. Today we'll do that a little bit, touch on some developments around controversial developments, like in West Harlem and the Domino Sugar Factory. And we'll make it really interactive today, and we'll tell you how in a minute. But Lockhart, this has been a fun month. Thanks again for doing this.
Oh, Brian, it's been my pleasure. It's great to be here.
And as I said, let's make it really interactive and really wide open today. So listeners, call in with real estate stories from your neighborhood that you think would be of interest to Curbed. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. They can be outrages about who's getting foreclosed upon or evicted. They can be how you see real estate prices continuing to change in your neighborhood. Are we really immune from the real estate downturn or not in our area? They can be great deals on rent or purchase prices that you know of near you, if you're not going to scoop it up yourself. They can be broker horror stories, broker funny stories. They can be the coolest new house or apartment that you've seen in your nabe. Curb always has some cool new ones up there on their site.
Kind of stuff.
Or whatever. Call us for the Curbed Wire of the Air, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And while your calls are coming in, let's touch on a few things. Lockhart, on the bursting of the bubble,
right?
The latest stats this week say foreclosures in the five boroughs are up 97% compared to a year ago. Last month, they were just up 30% from a year ago. How big an indicator is this?
Well, it's significant, but you have to look at which neighborhoods are being impacted here. I think the number of foreclosures in Manhattan was only 79 out of a giant batch of something like 1,000 across the five boroughs. So, you know, I think what we're seeing here is that it certainly is affecting probably people in sort of the outerlying boroughs more than it is people in Manhattan. So it shouldn't give people the sense that, you know, you're about to find Fifth Avenue on sale.
And overall, real estate prices for our region are down about 4% from a year ago, according to the Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Index. That compares to an 8% drop in San Diego, a 9% drop in Tampa, and a 10% drop in Detroit. Any thoughts on what those numbers mean besides the obvious?
Well, I think it kind of is the obvious. I mean, I think New York is still relatively insulated from some of the hits that are happening, you know, other places in this country. And, you know, whether that's going to remain the case or not remains to be seen.
Yeah, and I know, as you say, of course, it's different neighborhood by neighborhood, but a 4% drop, to take that number, doesn't even make buying a home that much more affordable. It means a $500,000 home would go down to $480,000.
Yeah.
A $200,000 home to $192,000.
And you look at all the appreciation over the last couple of years. I mean, you're not even getting people, you know, you're not even getting back to asking prices from just 2 years ago at that point. So it's, you know, I think it's still a heady market. There's no question.
By the way, have you heard those gleeful radio commercials advertising foreclosed homes for sale? You know, they go like, what's bad news for somebody, maybe good news for you.
Right.
Is there a certain kind of market in foreclosed homes?
I mean, sure there is. You know, but of course you have to be willing to get down a little dirty. I mean, we do a feature on Curb called Asked Curbed, where the readers write in a question about the real estate market or actually anything that they don't know about.
Uh-huh.
And what we do is we have all the other readers in the comment section just jump in and answer the question. And we did a question back in August asking this very question. You know, a reader wrote in saying, you know, should I be getting into the foreclosed homes market? Is this a good way to buy a place? And if someone ran a search for foreclosures on Curb, they'd see it. But it was a lot of different debate, and you saw a lot of both sides, some people thinking that there is a legitimate opportunity here, and there's some really good websites out there. The property research website, propertyshark.com,
mm-hmm.
which is run by some great guys out of Brooklyn, they do a really good job tracking foreclosures, and the site is useful to people. If somebody does want to get involved in that market, Brian, it's a good that's a good source.
Well, why would a foreclosed home sell for cheaper than if the same home was simply being put up for sale by the owner?
Usually it would just be because they want to move the property really quickly. It's the bank at that point, or, you know, the person holding the mortgage that wants to liquidate it. And whereas if you or I were selling our apartment, we might be willing to hold out for a better price. In their case, there's usually just a sense of just volume and the desire to kind of get the problem over with. So that's the thinking anyway.
Lockhart Steele, publisher of Curbed, and we can take your phone calls now. Our lines are full at 212-433-WNYC, and Gail in the East Village, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I didn't think you'd get to me so soon. because the rental market has gotten so extremely tight, the problem that my fellow tenants and I are facing, my landlord now owns more than 10 buildings, and they have been getting people out who are rent-stabilized, rent-controlled, and in the process of, you know, writing the check, the lips are sealed, which makes it that much harder to defend against saying, you know, you've done this before. I don't know if it's appropriate or pertinent, but is there any way your guest might know of a site or an NYC resource where we can get a list of previous tenants in different buildings? I did manage to get a list of some of the buildings.
I'm not sure I quite understand the question. Lockhart, did you?
Well, yeah, I think what she's getting at is is there a way to sort of find out through public records people who previously lived and rented in your building? Is that right?
Oh, I see. To see if the in a stabilized building or rent-controlled building, if the rent increase for the new tenant is legit? Is that it, Gail? What?
They've gotten almost everybody out of my building, and it's now down to very few of each category.
That's a good question. I honestly don't think there is a public record that is accessible in that way. Although if there is, I'd love to be corrected by another caller, because that would be really useful information to get out there. But this is the kind of thing where we do get people sort of gathering on the internet, on message boards, and on sites like Curbed, where people at the very least can try and find each other, and I think that's my best advice to try and get people together digitally.
And if anybody does have a more specific answer to that question, you can also post it on our comments page, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We have a page for this segment. Veronica in Yonkers, you're on WNYC. Hello, Veronica.
Hello. How's everyone?
Hi.
Great. What you doing?
Well, I'm a mortgage default counselor for Westchester County. I work for Westchester Residential Opportunities. And we have a mortgage default counseling program that has been increasing. And we've been following the federal and the local and the state governments to find out what they're going to do to resolve these foreclosures in Westchester County and in the country. And we aren't satisfied with the results. And we've been trying to, you know, make a point and a difference. And we've got so many issues, you know, against us, forces against us. And we're starting to have we're going to have a Don't Borrow Trouble program, which is a Freddie Mac-sponsored program to assist in communicating prevention of foreclosure and the warning signs, better warning signs of predatory and subprime loans.
That sounds great. I mean, I think there can't be enough information out there about this kind of stuff.
You say you're in Yonkers. Are there certain neighborhoods or towns within Westchester or cities where you see the foreclosures as particularly on the rise?
Yes. We're responsible, as I said, in Westchester County, and Yonkers and Mount Vernon are top of the list.
Yeah.
And we're looking at a target area of Peekskill, Mount Vernon, Yonkers, New Rochelle, White Plains. And, I mean, they're at the top of the list.
And are they primarily people who have these variable rate subprime mortgages?
Most definitely. Mm-hmm. They have, a lot of them have purchased a loan and they're already in foreclosure and they're not even there. They may have just made 12 months.
Veronica, good luck. Keep up the important work. Now, we have two callers who may be complaining about the same building. Let's see. Barbara in Manhattan and Judith in Chelsea. You're on WNYC. Judith, hi.
Hi.
Barbara, hi.
Hello.
Judith, what's your story?
I'm complaining that the new building on 19th Street that's going up will cover over the 10-story Knox Martin mural, which has always been visible from the highway on the edge of the Bayview Correctional Facility and is currently magnificently reflected in the new Gary Building on 12th Avenue.
Barbara, are you calling about the same building?
No, a different one.
Okay. What one?
On the southwest corner of 19th Street and 3rd Avenue. It's blocking the view that I'm one of the things I moved here for, of the Empire State Building at night lit up, which went along with the Chrysler Building, and the view of that white insurance building over by Madison Square Park.
So Lockhart, 19th Street must be hot because we have complaints from 3rd Avenue to 12th Avenue from these two
callers. Yeah, well, over on 11th Avenue, the one the first caller was talking about, that's actually a pretty interesting story. There is a great, if you drive up and down the West Side Highway, you're probably familiar with it. It's a great, huge mural that's been there forever. And it is, it's a Jean Nouvel, incredible architecture building that's going up there. And what I would say is the saving grace is that I think it's a pretty beautiful building that they're going to put up in that spot. It's not a generic, you know, ugly block. It's that whole stretch of 19th Street over by the Frank Gehry Building, is really going to be is just an unbelievable architecture playground.
So this is one of the stories of our time. There is so much construction going up and so much tall construction going up that's taller than what was there before that it's blocking all kinds of views of things that people are used to having views of, and it's a classic New York City conflict.
Yeah, I mean, and it's you know, that mural situation is one of those where you just sort of throw up your hands and say, I don't know what the answer is other than the developer owns the land and the mural is not landmarked or anything like that. So it's just one of those things that might just be, I guess the saving grace is maybe the mural is going to be there, and when the building gets torn down in 50 years, people will see it again.
Judith and Barbara, good luck. Debbie on the Upper West Side wants to answer the first caller's question about looking up the rent histories. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, yes. I'm a rent control tenant in a co-op building, and I'm the only renter, and it's really been hell. They've been putting glue in my locks. They've been putting ads in the paper saying my age and that I'm going to be dead soon, and they want to rent it out. You know, they've been doing so many crazy things, and I've been trying my best to fight within the system, and it's not easy, believe me. And I was very happy that WNYC is the only news media outlet that reported yesterday that the city council passed a law that buildings above 97th Street cannot, you know, be taller than a certain amount. And I wanted to thank WNYC for telling me that, because our infrastructure cannot, we have seven buildings that are literally going up in the 99th or 100th Street all across the West Side.
Right, I've seen that. And yet, Lockhart, I was going to bring this one up with you because it's a very limited prohibition. It only goes up to, I don't think it starts at 97th Street. I think it starts lower than that, but it only goes up to 110th Street. So if people want to start building high in Harlem as that continues gentrify and value, it looks like the Upper West Siders have protected only themselves right now.
Yeah, and these sort of down zone battles, you know, we've seen them on the Lower East Side as well, and now on the Upper East Side after they built these two tall condo buildings, the Ariel buildings on the Upper West Side. I mean, it's something I think everyone in their own neighborhoods, if it's of concern, that people should figure out what the current zoning status is for their neighborhoods. In a lot of cases, it's been areas that historically have not had high-rise buildings, and people would think, wow, there could never be a high-rise building in my neighborhood, but in a lot of cases, the reality is the zoning may very well allow it, and by the time you figure that out, you know, the building has already been built.
Yeah, the last two callers have similar situations, really, the two who are on together. There's the question of the shock and horror that they have as individuals to lose their views or the views of others driving by in the case of the mural. But then there's the separate question of the law.
Well, yeah, and I think, listen, New York's a great skyscraper city. There are a lot of wonderful tall buildings, but it's just a question of neighborhood context, and I think that's where these battles have been the fiercest, is neighborhoods that have just always been very low-rise, and then to suddenly have a 20-story, 30-story, 40-story tower dropped in the middle of that, it's jarring. It can be jarring just simply from an aesthetic perspective.
By the way, someone else is calling in to say that DHCR, the Department of... the Housing and Community Renewal Department, that's what it is, has a record of all previous tenants and rents for controlled and stabilized buildings. But Lockhart, while we're on the Upper West Side, there are developments today in the Columbia University expansion plan in the West 125th Street to 133rd Street area by the river. This huge auxiliary campus that would be bigger than the main campus. Apparently, they have a newly negotiated community benefits agreement. They would now create a park around 125th and 12th. The whole thing is all the way west for people who don't know that area, where actually, as Columbia loves to point out, less than 200 people currently live.
Yeah.
And for the first time, they have the endorsement of the Manhattan Borough President, Scott Stringer. So what's new here?
Well, it's just the whole Columbia process that's playing out is just a classic political horse trading process. I think there's always been the sense that Columbia was going to find a way to develop this area. It's really, the bigger question was simply under what terms and zoning they were going to be able to do it. And, here they've agreed to invest a certain amount back into the community, which always made sense. And, to go back to the zoning high-rise issue we were just talking about, I think the other issue that is being hopefully resolved in this case is how tall could Columbia build over there? I think there's a feeling that if they did redevelopment and it was contextual with the neighborhood, that could work out. If they dropped a whole series of giant towers in over there, that could throw people for a bit of a loop. So I think what's happening here is you're just seeing the process getting closer to what I've always sort of thought was sort of the ultimate likelihood that Columbia, of course, would be able to develop here. And it's just a question of, under what terms with the community that would be allowed.
I said we'd mention the Domino Sugar Factory agreement.
Right. Well, that one to me, for listeners who didn't hear it, Domino Sugar Factory in Williamsburg was landmarked this week. I think that's actually a little bit of a hollow landmarking. The main land, people are familiar with looking across the East River or when you're going across the bridge to Williamsburg and seeing the Domino Sugar Factory
there.
That's
a Manhattan-centric statement. Just wanted to call you on that.
That's a fair point. I'm certainly a Manhattan guy. But anyone familiar with the building, the part of it that's the most memorable is where it says Domino Sugar. You have this giant, great sign. And that's actually not part of what's been protected under this landmarking. And they've shown plans for the site where they're kind of preserving the main building, which is, that's fine, but there's just a plan to kind of pack a ton of different towers around it. So it sounds for people who love that sort of old industrial feel of New York and want to see that preserved, to sort of hear that the Domino Factory was landmarked sounds like this great victory. I think it's actually a little bit hollower than that.
And I just want to mention this wacky thing that we found online, and we've linked to it on our webpage if you want to see it. Apparently, this building that the Navy built somewhere out west. You're familiar with this?
Oh, this was in San Diego, right?
In San Diego, where, of course, it's a big Navy town. And they built this building, and now that there is Google Earth, you can see from the sky, when you zoom from the top way down on the building, that it's actually built in the shape of a swastika.
Oh, my God.
And from what I read so far, they didn't know they were building a building in the shape of a swastika, and nobody ever looked at it from that vantage point before, until this technology became so available to the average person to zoom way in. But, if they ever want to give up the Pentagon, I guess they could move into here and call it the Swastagon.
That's crazy. I'm looking at the link on your website. That's an unbelievable story.
It is on our website, and you can go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show if you want to see the newly revealed Navy Swastagon in San Diego. Let's see if we can get one more real estate horror story in here from Marjorie in Morningside Heights. Marjorie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What happened?
Well, I live actually near the high-rise that went up on 105th and Central Park West that Columbia owns a lot of those units, and it's really changed the neighborhood, so it sort of blends some of the last callers. But I have a condo, and when we moved in, when there was an open house, we heard a lot of banging from the apartment below. And we asked the selling real estate person what the banging was, and he told us that they were remodeling. Then at the closing, we heard the banging again, and he said they were remodeling. Well, from the day we moved in 3.5 years ago till now, and we have these downstairs neighbors that are convinced that our floors are somehow defective and bang on the ceiling all day at us whenever they hear us in the apartment. Huh. And they've been doing it for 10 years, even though we've been there for 3.5.
We're out of time, so I'm going to have to get a quick reaction from Lockhart.
I mean, these stories always blow my mind, is all I can say.
It's New York in a nutshell, and I know that from our screener that story goes on with lawsuits and stuff like that, but it's noise in New York, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's the narrative of the city, as you just said.
Lockhart Steele, publisher of the really cool real estate blog, Curbed.com. Thanks a lot for doing Thursdays with us this month.
It's been great this month, Brian. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.